This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, November 6th, 2009. From New York City, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's program, ExxonMobil has signed a deal to develop a major oil field in Iraq.
It's the first time that a U.S.-led multinational oil consortium is inking a deal with the Iraqi oil ministry.
UN climate talks in Barcelona end today, and activists begin a hunger strike to force governments to take action on climate change.
Main thing for me is that I really just don't want to look back and think that I could have done more.
And in the wake of Thursday's shooting at Fort Hood, Texas, we'll take a look at mental health professionals in the armed forces and the pressures they face.
He was a psychiatrist who heard the stories of all the young men and women who came home and talked about the things that they saw and the things that they did.
Those stories and more right after the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A U.S. brokered plan in Honduras to form a temporary unity cabinet has failed, according to ousted President Manuel Zelaya. The coup government, led by Roberto Micheletti, announced the formation of a new government that does not include the former president. This violates the terms of the latest compromise, which also dictated that the country's Congress should vote whether Zelaya should be reinstated. Micheletti stated in a televised address that Zelaya did not send a list of cabinet members to be considered in the unity government, which will be in place until elections are held at the end of November. Zelaya negotiator Jorge Reina spoke to reporters.
La violación permanente a los derechos humanos.
The permanent violation of human rights, the cancellation of public freedoms, the censorship of media. The elected president is surrounded by soldiers at the Brazilian embassy. This is all proof the coup government is preparing to commit political and electoral fraud on November 29th.
The deposed president has called for a boycott of those elections. The U.S. unemployment rate has broken the double-digit mark, rising to 10.2% in October. According to the Labor Department, 15.7 million people in the U.S. are unemployed. The rate is the highest since 1983. Although more jobs were lost last month, the number lost was lower than in previous months. Today, President Obama signed another piece of legislation designed to help the sagging economy. The bill extends unemployment benefits by 14 to 20 weeks, cuts taxes on businesses,
and will extend the tax credit for all homebuyers through April of next year while strengthening it with stronger anti-fraud measures. The rebound in the housing market was one of the big factors that contributed to the growth of the economy last quarter and brought hundreds of thousands of families into the housing market. We want to give even more families the chance to own their own home.
Another of Obama's big agenda items, health care, will see debate and a possible vote Saturday in the House of Representatives. After elections this week, Democrats have filled two empty House seats.
The chair announces to the House that in light of the administration of the oath of office to the gentleman from New York, the whole number of the House is 435.
Nancy Pelosi today at a swearing-in ceremony of newly elected Representative Bill Owens. California Democrat John Garamendi was sworn in yesterday. Filling those seats is important for Democrats, who are making the last-minute push to wrangle enough votes to pass the $1.1 trillion bill. Right now, language surrounding abortion is a major sticking point. For months, Representative Anthony Weiner has insisted that a single-payer plan get a vote on the House floor as well. But now he has withdrawn, saying he became concerned it would undermine the chances of the consensus plan passing. That plan does contain a public option. The area surrounding the northern Mexican city of Monterrey appears to be teetering on the brink of increased cartel violence after the murder of a crime boss. Shannon Young has more.
The industrialized city of Monterrey and its wealthy suburbs have been spared the level of drug violence plaguing other large northern cities. But things appear to be changing. All 78 municipal police of the town of Garcia have been called in for questioning after last night's murder of the recently installed chief of police and his four bodyguards. The massacre came shortly after Mauricio Fernandez, the mayor of the elite community of San Pedro Garza García, publicly advocated for the formation of armed self-defense squads to combat organized crime. The mayor's advocacy of private commandos has prompted mixed reactions, including warnings that it could lead to Colombian-style paramilitary violence. Shannon Young, FSRN.
Monday will be the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the freedom of the East German people, and the symbolic end of the Cold War. But still, many who suffered at the hands of the secret police under communist East Germany have yet to see justice. FSRN's Cinnamon Napard has more from Berlin.
The Stasi, the feared East German secret police, interrogated, tortured, and imprisoned thousands of people, while hundreds of thousands of others were spied upon by informers who were often friends, family, and colleagues. In the first 10 years following the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was an effort to bring justice to those who suffered. But despite almost 80,000 investigations, there were only 993 prosecutions and less than 100 convictions. Even Erich Milke, Minister for State Security and head of the Stasi, spent less than 2 years in jail, and he was never held accountable for his actions in the German Democratic Republic. It wasn't until 2007 that victims of the Stasi were granted a pension by the German federal government. They now receive €250 a month, but only if they were jailed for more than 6 months and earn less than around €12,500 a year. But even to apply for this small amount, victims must prove what happened. While the Stasi kept meticulous files, there's a 2-year backlog to get access, and many of the files were shredded as the GDR collapsed. Cinnamon Nippard, FSRN, Berlin.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. As the nation mourns the victims of Thursday's shooting at Fort Hood, Texas, many are reflecting on the challenges facing men and women in the military. Suspected shooter Major Nidal Malik Hassan was himself a psychiatrist who counseled soldiers returning from war. FSRN's Tanya Snyder examines what happens when there's a crisis among mental health professionals in the armed forces.
13 people died and an estimated 30 were injured when Army psychiatrist Nidal Malik Hassan allegedly opened fire on soldiers at Fort Hood Thursday. It wasn't the first time tragedy had struck the town of Killeen in central Texas. In 1991, a man drove his truck through a cafeteria window and shot more than 40 people, killing 23. That was the deadliest U.S. shooting spree to date, until 2007, when a Virginia Tech student killed 33 people, including himself. Major Nidal Hassan graduated from Virginia Tech 10 years earlier. And Thursday also wasn't the first time there's been a serious breakdown in the military's mental health system.
The mental health services are there, but there's not enough of them.
Army Specialist Michael Kern is part of the Fort Hood chapter of Iraq Veterans Against the War. He struggled with post-traumatic stress disorder when he returned from Iraq.
I went down to the mental health facility and I was like, look, I'm having a lot of problems. I need to talk to someone. They're like, okay, we'll schedule you an appointment. My appointment was scheduled for 2 months out. And in between that 2 months, I went to a psych ward. I mean, I broke down mentally.
Returning soldiers struggle with a host of problems, including PTSD. Pacifica contributor Aaron Glantz, author of The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, and a researcher of mental health issues in the military, says combat isn't the only cause of death for U.S. soldiers.
They die after they come home, when they kill themselves. Because they can't live with their experiences in the war zone. They die when the system fails them and fails to treat their war wounds adequately. They die when they end up in an altercation with law enforcement, when law enforcement doesn't understand how to deal with a veteran with post-traumatic stress disorder.
But Major Hassan hadn't even seen combat. He hadn't been deployed overseas yet. He was awaiting deployment to Afghanistan, to a war he reportedly opposed. No one knows what motivated him or what could have prevented this tragedy from occurring. But many speculate that he was a victim of secondary post-traumatic stress. That as a psychiatrist, he had heard so many devastating stories from returning soldiers that he was torn apart by experiences that weren't even his own. Specialist Kern says he believes it could happen.
The things I talk about with my psychiatrist is I actually did engage and kill in cold blood a child in Iraq. And it plagues me every day that I have to go through this. And it does help talk it out with people. And, you know, that could have just pushed them over the edge.
It's hard for the Army to recruit and maintain mental health professionals that could be making a lot more money in private practice without risking their lives in a war zone. Glantz says there may not have been enough trained psychiatrists around to identify and treat one of their own.
The number of psychiatrists working in the military actually has gone down over the course of the war. So right when we most need military psychiatrists, we actually have fewer of them in uniform.
But not everyone is convinced that secondary PTSD is to blame. Solomon Williams is the acting associate chief of staff for mental health for the Central Texas Veterans Administration.
I would expect that people who are actually in combat will have more problems than those who experience secondary trauma. It just makes sense to me. And I think the research also supports that. Are there people who have, because of their job, heard many stories who could be affected? Sure. But I do not believe that secondary PTSD is a major clinical epidemic. I haven't seen that.
Muslim groups around the country quickly condemned the shooting, even before the suspect's Islamic faith was disclosed. President Obama announced that flags at all federal buildings will be flown at half staff until Veterans Day, next Wednesday. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
And in news that's still breaking, another shooting took place in Florida today. Around lunchtime, a gunman opened fire at the Gateway Center in downtown Orlando. Police report one person was killed and five injured. ExxonMobil and Royal Dutch Shell have signed a deal with the Iraqi oil ministry to develop a major oil field in Basra, southern Iraq. The $50 billion deal is the first American-led venture into Iraq since the oil industry was nationalized in 1972. It's also the second major deal signed this week, a signal that perhaps multinational oil companies are ready to return to Iraq and make huge profits. We're joined by Charlie Cray. He's the director of the Center for Corporate Policy, a nonpartisan public interest group based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you, Dorian.
What's the significance of the deal that was signed yesterday?
Well, this is a foot-in-the-door type of arrangement for particularly ExxonMobil. It's the first time that a U.S.-led multinational oil consortium is inking a deal with the Iraqi oil ministry. And they do not have, under this agreement, marketing rights or other types of oil rights that they would like down the road.
So but it is limited at this point. The contract is, it's called a service contract.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what could be the next steps? What could it lead to?
Well, Iraq is expected to hold a second bidding round in December for 10 unexplored oil and gas fields, and ExxonMobil, along with others, including British Petroleum, Luke Oil, who was leading the competitive consortium that lost to ExxonMobil on this deal, the Chinese National Petroleum Corporation, or CNPC, which already has a deal for a different oil field similar to the Exxon deal, and Italian corporation Eni and other oil giants are expected and eligible to participate in that December auction.
So the country's former oil minister, Issam al-Chalibi, has criticized the deal, saying that ordinary Iraqis would not benefit. So although there is a lot of support within Iraq, the support doesn't seem to be completely uniform. How has the control of the oil industry in Iraq changed since the U.S. invasion in 2003?
Well, it's become much more complex. You have inter-regional rivalries between, for instance, the Kurdish regional government and the Iraqi oil ministry and other regions over control over the contracting as well as the revenue streams. You have lots of bickering between the parliament and the oil ministry. It's been since 2004 really, or five, that the proposal has been made to pass a new oil law, and it hasn't gone anywhere. And this is the much-stalled hydrocarbon law that would set up the framework and define foreign participation.
Talk about the significance of this particular oil field in West Kerna.
Well, this is a known oil field, and Iraq, of course, has a lot of oil that is part of their known reserves. What I think the multinationals are salivating over are the exploration and production deals, because then they would essentially have more access over the entire exploration, production, and marketing of whatever oil comes out of these new fields.
So you've called this deal this week limited in its influence for right now, but could this put ExxonMobil in a position to be a big player in post-war Iraq?
Yes. I mean, this is, since it is the first deal that Exxon has signed, you can expect that they will mobilize personnel and equipment into the region and, set up essentially base camp for expanding their involvement in Iraq. Of course, that depends on a lot of other factors, including political stability, as you can imagine, and security. But for now, this is the first time that ExxonMobil has a deal with the Iraqi government, and that makes it very significant.
We've been speaking with Charlie Cray about the $50 billion deal between ExxonMobil and the Iraqi oil ministry signed this week. It's the first time in more than three decades that a U.S. oil giant will be developing Iraq's oil. Charlie Cray is the director of the Center for Corporate Policy. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
UN climate talks in Barcelona wound down today with little progress made in negotiations. Developing nations say rich countries like the United States, which produce a disproportionate amount of the world's CO2, have pledged too little to reduce emissions. Meanwhile, with the Copenhagen Climate Conference just a month away, activists and NGOs are trying to keep the pressure on governments to act decisively. In Australia, one group of activists is already taking action by going on a hunger strike. And as FSRN's Tom Allen reports, it's an idea that's spreading around the globe.
It sounds like any other meal, but for Paul Connor and his companions in Canberra, Australia, this may be their last food for 40 days.
The main thing for me is that I really just don't want to look back in 20, 30 years' time and think that I could have done more.
Connor came up with the idea for the hunger strike in December after the Australian government published watered-down plans to combat climate change. Australia, the world's top coal exporter, pledged just a 5 to 15% cut in CO2 emissions by 2020.
I've admired Mahatma Gandhi for many years, and it really literally changed my life when I read about Gandhi's hunger strikes. Like, I thought that was just incredible that somebody would care about justice so much that they would stop eating in order to see it done. So that, combined with how upset I was at the Australian government's position, led to the idea.
And that idea has now spread around the world. According to organisers with Climate Justice Fast, 80 people in 14 different countries are now joining in, some for just a day, like Sandeep Srivastava in India, some for the 12 days of the conference, like Howard Bulmer in England. He explained how he'd become inspired by people he's never met or seen.
It just started through emails, and then through Skype. Paul and Anna were saying, look, we're going to do 40 plus days, and it just blew everyone away. You know, suddenly the hunger strike really seemed appropriate.
Like a similar global day of climate action last month, fasters are demanding that leaders of Western countries commit to stabilising greenhouse gases below 350 parts per million. Fasts are also taking place in Canada, South Africa, Belgium and Honduras. And in New York Friday, participants beginning a week-long fast held a vigil outside the United Nations. According to organisers, a core group of fasters will only drink water from now until the end of the Copenhagen conference. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tom Allen, reporting from Edinburgh.
And for more information or to see videos of the fasters, visit climatejusticefast.com. This week, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced that about 35 million doses of the H1N1 swine flu vaccine had been ordered. Though the Department of Health has been setting up free vaccination clinics across the country, there is still a shortage of the drug. In this reporter's notebook, FSRN's Sam Greenspan gives us an on-the-ground look at the vaccination campaign in Washington, D.C.
On October 29, 2009, I rode the Red Line train to Tenleytown, an upper-middle-class neighborhood in northwest D.C., to get vaccinated against the H1N1 swine flu virus at a public clinic set up at Wilson High School. Even though it was 3:30 when I arrived, a full 90 minutes before the scheduled start time, there were already several hundred people ahead of me in line. Half an hour later, there were another several hundred people behind me. Beginning at the door of the high school, the line ran across the school parking lot, eventually wrapping around the massive three-story building on three sides. On the sidewalk, parents pushed toddlers in strollers, and in the street, cars circled the block searching for parking spaces. Spirits were fairly high, though. The Red Cross had set up a truck to serve free coffee and hot cocoa, and Department of Health employees circled the line, answering questions from those hoping for the vaccine.
Hello, thanks for coming. Do you guys have any questions at all?
Or? We didn't know if you were doing an update, just if they're out of shots.
No, we're not out.
Okay,
we're not out.
This
should be fine.
All right, thanks. Yeah.
Some have reasons to be skeptical about their chances of actually getting the vaccine. That day was the second time Ahlam Naeem, a D.C. resident, had tried to get the vaccination for her three daughters.
Yesterday, I waited in Rockville for like 1 hour, and when I reached there, they told me it's gone already. So, I mean, there is something wrong with the system, I think. I mean, whenever we are waiting, at least we have to be sure that they will give us. But until now, I'm not sure we will get it, like what happened yesterday.
Naeem is not eligible for the vaccine, though. To get the drug, one must be either under 25, over 64, pregnant, have chronic health problems like asthma, or provide primary care for an infant. When I finally got inside the school, the line resembled one for an amusement park ride, snaking around to prevent you from ever seeing the front or how much further you have to go. This vaccination attempt is the largest coordinated public health effort that the Obama administration has put forward, and might be the largest vaccination campaign against the flu ever. And though the vaccination here in D.C. was free, there might be a hidden cost to contend with. The effects of seeing people waiting in a long line for an unknown quantity of vital goods. I got to leave Wilson High School that day with the H1N1 antibodies in my arm and an I got my flu shot sticker on my shirt, but only because I'm under 25 and had a flexible schedule that allowed me to show up in the early afternoon and stand in line for 3 hours. It's not known how many people were and weren't vaccinated that day. The DOH wouldn't talk to me on record at the high school, and when I called their office, they wouldn't say how many vaccines were distributed at any given clinic. With the ongoing debate about the role that public health care will play in coming years, it's possible that this vaccination campaign will shape public opinion on the ability of government to provide health services. How the DOH vaccinates the public against H1N1 could very well have an impact on the confidence of voters in a public option. For FSRN's Reporter's Notebook, I'm Sam Greenspan in Washington, D.C.
Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger today signed California's most sweeping water overhaul in almost half a century. The legislation is aimed at protecting fragile delta ecosystems and modernizing the water system in a state now in its third year of drought. The measures split environmentalists as lawmakers crafted a plan to build new dams, cut water use, and update a water system for farms in Southern California cities. FSRN's Christopher Martinez reports from Sacramento.
Mark Twain once wrote, "Whiskey is for drinking, water is for fighting over." In California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is hoping to end the state's long-running water wars by signing a sweeping package of water measures.
This was a big battle and a big, like a holy war, called it, in a water field, and now finally it was done.
The landmark legislation declares environmental restoration and a reliable water system as co-equal goals in the hopes of solving conflicts that have pitted environmentalists against farmers, cities against agribusiness, and Northern California against the southern part of the state. The water package includes an $11 billion water bond for conservation projects, environmental restoration, and new dams and reservoirs. The package could also clear the way for a giant canal to ship water from Northern California to farms in the Central Valley and cities in Southern California, home to two-thirds of the state's population. At the heart of California's water system is the fragile San Joaquin-Sacramento Delta. It's the largest estuary on the west coast of the Americas, where environmental damage has devastated salmon and other threatened species, and where federal judges have intervened to order cuts in the amount of water shipped south. State Senate President Daryl Steinberg praises the water package, saying it solves the unsolvable and will create hundreds of thousands of new high-wage jobs.
It is about infrastructure, but it is about so much more. It is about dramatically improving the environment, whether it is restoring the Delta ecosystem, whether it is the highest levels of environmental review for all the projects that that will happen, whether it is the conservation bill, 20% here in California, whether it's groundwater monitoring. The reason why this is so significant is because it is so comprehensive.
The water package split environmental groups, with some saying the measures would protect the Delta ecosystem, while others criticize new dam and canal construction. Brett Baker of the group Restore the Delta testified at a hearing before the vote.
We remain opposed to the bond. We feel that this process has been fatally flawed from the get-go. We don't see any reason to be rushing through such an important issue for the state of California and future generations.
Other environmentalists support the measure. Leo Wintern of the Nature Conservancy said the package is needed to create a reliable water supply and to protect threatened and endangered species in the Delta.
For those concerned with the state's water system and who seek funding for infrastructure such as pipes, canals, and dams, consider also that ecosystem restoration is an equally important piece of water infrastructure for this state. Without restoration, it is likely that we will not be able to recover the listed species, and without recovery of listed species, we will not have water supply reliability.
Among the most controversial water issues is a so-called peripheral canal to ship water around the Delta to the Valley and Southern California. Critics of a canal describe it as a ditch as wide as a 10-lane highway and longer than the Panama Canal. Democratic lawmaker Allison Huber voted against the water projects.
They may have passed these bills, but I don't think they've actually solved the water problem. This was a deal negotiated in the dead of night. The bond kept getting larger and larger as they were putting more pork in to gain enough votes for passage.
Schwarzenegger signed the water package Friday morning, marking what may be the last big political victory of his time as governor. But questions remain about how effective the measures will be for the ecosystem and for California's water supply. California voters will have the final say on the centerpiece of the measures when they vote next November on an $11 billion bond to pay for the projects. Christopher Martinez, Free Speech Radio News, Sacramento.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Today's Washington, D.C. editor is Tanya Snyder. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.